In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Tuesday, November 11th, 2014. And on this Veterans Day, we're joined by Murray Polner, co-author with me of the book We Who Dared to Say No to War, American Anti-War Writing from 1812 to Now. Murray is the author of numerous books on a wide variety of topics, including Branch Rickey, a biography, Disarmed and Dangerous, The Radical Lives and Times of Daniel and Philip Berrigan, No Victory Parades, The Return of the Vietnam Veteran, and Rabbi, The American Experience. Murray's writings have appeared in the New York Times, Newsday, The Nation, and many other outlets. He was the editor of Present Tense, published by the American Jewish Committee, for 18 years. Murray, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Tom.
I've had this show for over a year, Murray. I can't believe it took me this long. I'm such a blockhead to have you on. I've had so many people tell me how much they enjoyed the collection that you and I worked on, We Who Dared to Say No to War. And I remember when you and I met for lunch that day, I remember It was rainy. For some reason, I remember that distinctly.
It was one of New York's stormiest, Long Island's stormiest days.
Yeah, that's right. But doggone it, something bright.
I said, that kid better have something good for me.
Yeah, that's right. This better be worth it. And you know, it was not easy because sometimes we had to navigate copyright restrictions and, you know, what's in the public domain and what isn't. But by and large, I mean, we came up with a great collection of really great anti-war stuff from a diverse array of people. That's what made it exciting.
Yes. And I saved every review. I'm sure you did, too. There wasn't a single negative review, not even in some of the much more right-wing, you know, hard-line, only in occasionally in a neocon publication that they have to put in a jab. But they're always bellicose, and they're always home-front warriors, so I never pay attention.
Yeah, I take that as a medal on my chest if they don't like what I do. But we even got a starred review from Publishers Weekly, which is hard to get.
That was super.
Yeah. I was really thrilled about that. Now, I want to talk about, obviously, I want to talk about the issue of war and so on and so forth, but I do want to start off talking a little bit about you. I gave people a little bit of your background and where you've written, but you've been involved in peace circles for, well, quite some time.
I did serve in the Naval Reserve, and I did serve on active military army duty and so forth. But I didn't get any lessons from that, but what I did was I was always involved. I was, from the beginning, a member of the Jewish Peace Fellowship, but I also was primarily interested in finding, not pacifists, but alternatives to conflict and war. Yeah, I read Gandhi, and I read Thoreau, and I read Tolstoy, and all the rest, but I was trying to find an American kind of thing. Our book helped me, because I found certain people I had never really thought about too much, but I was always interested. And primarily, I was a writer. I did march on and anti-war things and so forth. But I wrote several books that brought me deeply into it. One of the books that I'm always proud of is No Victory Parade. I was teaching in a community college some 60 miles from New York City. And I never introduced the war into my history classes because I felt that was unfair to students. And I sure wasn't going to push my opinion. But I also organized concerned faculty against the war, which was all teachers after that, and faculty and professors. And then I did it in another at a Catholic college that I taught. And therefore, I gave a talk on against the war. And while I was in my office for the visiting, you know, the students come in at your office hours, kid came in. And he said, it's just been 2-3 weeks after, or 6 weeks, I think, as I remember, after he was in the Central Highlands in Vietnam. And he said to me, Professor, excuse me, but I think you're full of shit. and he defended the war. And then I talked to somebody else there who had been in the war, and the result was I wrote No Victory Parades. I interviewed over 200 guys who had been in combat. And I also felt at the end what a lie the whole thing had been. As George Kennan famously said, what was our national interest in even in going in there? And George Kennan was right at that point. And then I wrote many other things. I wrote, and all sorts of things. Right now, I'm working about four or five different publications. One of them that I really love is called the George Mason University has a website called History News Network, and its editor, Shankman, is a terrific guy, and it's a terrific website. And I write about them all the time. I have a blog and so forth. What I do is I used to speak a lot to different groups. I don't speak anymore, but I like to write, and it's great fun, aging and writing. What the book that we did, Tom, did for me, it was opened up even more things that I never knew. And I know America has been a trap of its own, set by the Washington Consensus, as I would say the great Andrew Bacevich and former Senator James Webb have been talking about recently. And that is, it's endless wars, no entry, no exit, and moving more and more. Only wars that America should ever become involved, and that's what I've been writing about, are those that directly engage our national interest. Ukraine doesn't, Georgia didn't, of course Iraq and Afghanistan didn't, and so forth and so on. And one of the things I've been doing is reading a great deal as I did in Vietnam and in World War II, reading a great deal by the combatants themselves. An extraordinary number of volunteers, not draftees, because we wouldn't dare have a draft. Extraordinary number written about it. Recently, not long ago, last year, I had collected something like 10 or 15,000 books on Vietnam, and I donated them all free to Texas Tech University in Lubbock because they have the largest collection of Vietnam-era materials. And I want future generations to know what the hell we went through, and they went through. Another thing that triggered my interest was the murder of the Kent State kids. That's the one book that I regretted not writing about, although I'm writing a piece again. I've written several pieces about. I never could find a smoking gun, but it was horrible, and so forth and so on. And then I wrote a book about, with my friend Jim O'Grady, who wrote a biography of the Berrigan brothers, the two priests that decided that Dan was more religious, Phil was more political. They were going to upset the apple cart, and based upon much of what Thomas Merton wrote, based upon their religious background, political background, Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker, et cetera, they were an extraordinary group that I found very, very interesting. And then I worked in anti-draft movement and so forth and so on.
Murray, I want to go back to something you mentioned about yourself. I always wanted to ask you this, and somehow when we were working on the book, we were so busy, I was never able to do it. But I know about your involvement with the Jewish Peace Fellowship, and there must be a weird relationship between that kind of group and the neocons who believe that if you're Jewish, there's only...
I don't want to go into now, but I'm a real critic of the current Israeli government. And I don't believe they're interested at all. And Netanyahu has never been interested in allowing Palestinians to have their own sovereign, viable state. But yes, we were always outsiders. But look, in the recent election, 69% of American Jews, the only white Americans that voted Democratic and kind of moderate liberal candidates. Jews have always been traditionally liberal. Of course, what American Jewish, the Jewish so-called Israel lobby does is they depend largely on the money of billionaires who are very conservative, you know, and so forth and so on. But so the Jewish Peace Fellowship started in 1941 by a group of rabbis who felt that their numbers of Jews had been conscience objectors in World War II. Now, this is before news came out about the Holocaust. But even after, it was very difficult. A lot of their families abandoned them, and there was no one to support them. So what they did was, did what Quakers did, what the Mennonites did for their COs. They provided them with literature and visits, packages, food, and so forth and so on. When I got in, I was beginning very active in the anti-draft movement in 1967 and 68. As when I was teaching at various colleges, and I look for also because I'm very Jewish, and I'm very knowledgeable about my Jewish past, and I've written a book about the whole thing, and I've written all about my father and mother who lived through various pogroms and so forth and so on, so I decided that I wanted to find, as well as the secular group that I was with, find a Jewish group. So I found the Jewish Peace Fellowship. They were wonderful people. They were supported conscientiously. They didn't tell people to be a CO, but if they wanted to be, they told them the law, and then they supported them along the process. In fact, I have a lot of their documents I'm going to be submitting to the American Jewish Historical Society for to read.
Hang on, let me jump in for a second. I want to make sure people know that CO stands for conscientious objector. I mean, remember, we're dealing with a generation that doesn't know the draft, so they may not actually be familiar with this concept. Can you just take a minute to explain what the law was pertaining to conscientious objection?
Yeah, the last person, that poor sucker, poor guy, was drafted June 30, 1973. And the conscientious objectors initially said, America's been pretty good, except in World War One, they were terrible to conscientious objectors. Some 27 to 37 people were sentenced to death, though no one ever died, and they sent them to long prison terms and so forth. Americans go crazy periodically. Alien and sedition laws, red scares, McCarthyism, and all that horrible neo-fascist crap. Pardon me. But the conscientious objectors, America in World War Two was better and generous, and in Vietnam, extremely generous, but the whole system was breaking down selective service. If originally it said that you had to have a religious orientation, it had to be a Quaker, traditional historical religious groups, Quakers, Mennonites, Amish, and so forth and so on. During the war, a guy, it was it must have been the ACLU people, they applied for, went to the, they objected to it, and therefore they added you had to have not only you could have a religious objection or a very powerful ethical and moral objection to war. It couldn't be a particular war. It couldn't be a political instance. I don't like Bush. I don't like Obama, etc. That stuff had to be that you came from a world or you moved into a world that couldn't ethically, morally, or religiously support a war. And large numbers, increasing numbers of volunteers who joined after 9/11 have been discharged because they have since come to believe, or they had come since to believe, that war was not the answer for them. Well, they did not speak of the justice or right of the unjust and crazy invasion of Iraq, but they spoke about their feelings. And in many cases, the Defense Department accepted it. But they've learned that you don't want to be in it, then let them go. They got honorable discharge. And so, incidentally, a cause that I'm trying to get interested in, the numbers of volunteers in those military got dishonorable discharges, often for a very stupid, inane, trivial reasons. They're denied to this day, to this day, all the rights that a guy like me, who had an honorable discharge, get. It's a lot.
Well, that's interesting. I assumed there must have been a lot of people who were dishonorably discharged for reasons that were trivial. There's so many things I want to ask you, Murray, though, now that I have you on the phone here.
Write another book. That's what I wanted.
Yeah, I know. Look, that's you and I have the same answer to everything. Just write another book, see what happens, float it out there, see where it goes. Did you think in 1989, 1990, 1991, as the Cold War wound down, did you think that this meant the warfare state would be scaled back, or did you feel like even then, I've been around the block too much, I know these people will find some pretext for it?
I hope that with the end of collapse of communism, that there would be a new approach, not only to the ex-Soviet Union, but a new approach to without the nonsense about hegemony and global necessity of being involved and so forth. There were a few people that wanted to move in that direction, so-called national interest. You find them in their publication, national interest. They're all around. But I found that there were too many people invested in taking continuing a hard line, so that you're talking about not only the neocons who love war, although they'll never go and their kids never go, but you're talking about our merchants of death producing constant flow of advanced killing machines. You're talking about our think tanks, our lobbyists, our producers of everything from uniforms to, you know, to everything, our private contractors. They're thinking of, by then, there were still people still married to the Cold War mentality. And I've written about, for example, in the Ukraine, Gorbachev was promised by Bush 1 that the United States would never support its puppet, NATO, moving close to their borders, which would be a direct threat, just like if they moved close to Mexico or into Cuba. And when they started to do that, he complained. And they said, well, it's only an oral, verbal statement. And, of course, you see what happened almost happened in Georgia, certainly almost is happening in Ukraine. Yes, there were definite vested interests. It's very hard to break that mentality that we are one, USA, USA. And that's part of whatever's left of me is to write about and to talk about, is that we should only be involved when we are immediately, directly endangered. That none of our current, and China, the future enemy, is not on my list.
Well, okay. nor on mine. Now, I want to know, as somebody who has spent his life on the left, but not as part of the liberal establishment, certainly, which has not been good on war, contrary to popular belief, how do you respond when you see "Ready for Hillary" bumper stickers? This must enrage you.
On my watch, I get a little nauseous at times. You know, I mean, she's a hawk, or she'll be a moderate hawk like her husband, who evaded the draft, and then when he was president, you know, of course, sent everybody, bombers over Belgrade, over, you know, and Kosovo and so forth. There's nothing like people, take John Kerry, for example, the man who made his famous statement, who should be the last person to die in Vietnam for a war like Vietnam, said that in the Senate. He was a hero for the Vietnam Veterans Against War. And yet he turned to the extent that when you get into power, you take on the coloration of power frequency. You have to make all sorts of compromises, which is a very good argument again. So in answer to your question, what was the question?
Well, I mean, how do you assess this popularity of Hillary?
I love to watch Bill Maher on television sometimes. Last night, or Friday night, he said he hates the Republicans because they're all these homegrown warriors. But he said most of them, I don't know, not Walter Jones or anything.
Right.
But he also said that the Democrats, by and large, are so weak. My last two congressmen, somebody said to me, let's form a picket line. This was during one of the Iraq War. Out their offices. I said, they're so embedded, they're so involved, they're so pro-war, and even if they're not personally pro-war, my former congressman wrote me a letter. He said, when I processed it, he said, my wife disagrees with me, and I have two sons who are of age. And then when the war ended, you know, at least they more or less in Iraq, I wrote him a letter. He was out of office. He resigned, he retired. And I said, how long did your son serve in the military? Never got an answer.
Yeah, you know. Of course you didn't.
You know, these guys, Democrats, they're already, there's a progressive, I'm going to tell you, the Democrats have a progressive block in the Congress. A lot of them, but they're not very powerful. Bernie, whatever his name was.
Bernie Sanders.
Sanders was on Bill Maher's, very good. Doesn't stand a chance of help. Bill Greider, who quotes, what's his name? I forget, he quotes, William Greider quotes in the latest Nation, he quotes Albert Hunt, an old hand, a wise old hand in the Washington Press Corps, whose wife is not just one of the lead announcers on NPR radio, TV. He said, Jim Hunt could be Hillary Clinton's worst nightmare. I don't know. She probably would. Who knows what will happen? I do know that over the years, let me put it this way, as a left winger, more or less, I become, quote, more and more libertarian in the sense that you and I agree of war and civil liberties and some of the heavy-handed of people, not to say the federal government, but the way they operate. I wrote for a wonderful publication. I had a column. It just died, the newspaper, called New York. It was a watchdog on the New York Times, New York Times Examiner. And I wrote, for example, a series of articles on Obama, who I voted for twice. Second time, I regret it. Obama voted twice, though he's much better than the others. Obama violation of civil liberties and his attorney general, who's now retiring, with their constant use of Woodrow Wilson's outrageous 1917 Espionage Act. You know that, Tom, that they have used, he has used more indictments under the Espionage than every president combined throughout our history. Even John Adams, when he had the Sedition Act, didn't do that. Well, he didn't have it, etc. And so, and he's also has all this crazy little rule they put in that federal workers have to tell on, spy on their fellow workers if they hear something bad. I think of, you know, the old movies about the Nazis and the communists, you know, people spying on their parents. So, to that extent, we have to be very, very careful. Federal government is necessary. It's not in that direction.
Well, I don't know if I'll be able to persuade you otherwise on that, but I'm glad you're going in that kind of direction, Maury. But now, look, I want to ask you this. It's Veterans Day today, and it seems to me that things are getting weirdly more idolatrous every year in the incredible reverence shown to and compliments heaped upon the heads of veterans. I don't know if there's a phenomenon quite like this elsewhere in the world, that veterans get discounts, special privileges. Every football game starts with some military celebration. It is everywhere. It suffuses the whole culture. Left and right have bought into it. You're on an airplane. There are soldiers on the plane. You're expected to clap. It is everywhere, because without the soldier, you'd be speaking German or whatever it is. What is your response to that?
Well, my response is twofold. One is, as a veteran, my wife still tells me to take out the garbage.
Good.
And my grandchildren call me Grandpa. However, I understand what they're doing. This is. I agree with you. The over-militarization and the culture is impossible. It's drowning. I know a lot of veterans, and it's not only Vietnam, but also some of the kids that went and volunteered in Iraq. And they think it's mad. They just live their lives. But this is one, it's like, remember those bumper stickers, support our troops? Somebody made a lot of money on that.
Oh, yeah. Which,
you know, and what does that mean, support our troops? And secondly, there's a culture of militarism here that's come a crop. They haven't won a war since 1945, unless you count the glorious conquest of Grenada and Panama. And there's a guilt complex. I don't know what it is. And liberals, they feel they have to join in, you know, the right wing, join in. What are they saluting? I wrote a letter, it never got published. They had I'm a great baseball fan. and why I love the Mets. And they always have Wounded Warrior Day. And I wrote a letter to the Times Sports page, which they didn't publish. And I said, but they never mentioned why those guys were there wounded.
Yeah.
And what was the lie that brought them in? So I agree 1,000% of you. This is craziness that they have to go through. And this used to be called Armistice Day. And Armistice Day celebrated the end of another horrible, horrible 4 years of war, where some 60 million people were killed in the whole process, and 100,000 American soldiers were killed. And this is all forgotten.
Yeah, the change in emphasis is very clear and obvious.
And it's there's a very good article today, up in today's New York Times, by a retired general. And he said, how do you define insanity? If you define insanity by doing the same thing over and over and over again and expecting different results, then that's perfect definition of insanity.
Well, what did you think of that poll that found that most Americans supported the president's move against ISIS and most Americans didn't think it would work? That's insanity.
I know. It won't work. They do it. Just Americans, the hysteria over Ebola and the hysteria over this thing and that thing and ISIS. No one knows who ISIS is. Many of them came as a result of the failures in Iraq.
Yeah, and, no doubt.
And then, so they'll bomb and then so forth. You know, I just can't say. Americans, these polls are reflective of only the immediate headline. They ask complex questions, or they frame questions that are favorable to the responses. So I dismiss them. They are very confusing, and but they are. The best poll was when Kerry and Obama and maybe a came, I don't know who else on the Republican side, wanted a bomb, small bombing of Syria and support the rebels. No one who knew who the rebels were, of course. And surprisingly, the British Parliament said no, and surprisingly, the Americans said to their pollsters no. There's a certain point where Americans have a certain good sense, enough more of them, and most of us, and that is endless wars threaten everything, including their own children. The volunteer army is simply means that Americans don't want their kids drafted. And they sold a bill of goods to these kids who joined the National Guard or reserves or came in because they had no other economic opportunities or they were bored as teenagers or whatever. You know, I mean, I remember enlisting Naval Reservists. I didn't know what else to do. And it was a nice $10 check a month or something. So I think the polls are not confusing. Tomorrow's polls may be different. To get back to your basic question, after 1945, and especially when the war ended, and especially after the collapse of communism, it was a great opportunity. Gorbachev was the best Russian they would ever meet, and they failed. And because of whatever, all the interest, Washington, what's his name? I forget his name. He runs antiwar.com.
Justin Raimondo?
Yeah, he calls it the Imperial City. It really is the Imperial City. Cloistered, cut off from the rest of the segregated black city, well, many upper, middle and upper class blacks have joined. Who were very well there.
And separated economically, too. They're all prospering. Their salaries are very high. Home values are high. They're doing great.
In America?
In D.C., in the Imperial City. They're all doing great.
Yeah, right. Not the poorest section.
Yeah, no. Well, listen, Murray, I'm thrilled to have had you on today and be able to talk to you about all this stuff. I want to make sure people follow your blogging activity over on the History News Network.
They go to Murray Poehner, and they type in, there's no there.
Got it. Okay. And the spelling is Poehner, Murray Poehner.
Poehner.
Yes.
And take a look at the History News Network. It's a wonderful, it's not one point of view, it's many different points of view. But these are historians and journalists writing and arguing, and it's a lot of fun. And the editor is super.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed the History News Network myself. Well, Murray, thanks for Thanks for talking to us on Veterans Day in particular. Your insights and conversation are deeply meaningful to me, and I appreciate it.
Stay in touch. And kiss all your five children for me.
I certainly will. Thanks, Murray. All right, everybody. Our book together is called We Who Dared to Say No to War, American Anti-War Writing from 1812 to Now. I earn nothing on this book. Murray and I earn nothing on this book. When you do an anthology, you earn nothing. My literary agent refused to take on this project. He said anthologies do not sell. All right, fair enough, but we're glad we did it, right? It was a fun project. It needed to be done. And it was published by a major publisher, Basic Books, so that's always nice. But if you're interested, you can check that out on the books page at tomwoods.com or at Amazon, We Who Dared to Say No to War. I think it's great. It's a fun collection. It's got stuff from people all over the spectrum who were contemporaries of the various American wars of the past two centuries. A couple of fresh announcements. This one's not that fresh, but you know I have a new book out called Real Dissent, A Libertarian Sets Fire to the Index Card of Allowable Opinion. I think you guys will like it. It's informative in the sense that it's got a lot of arguments and information that you can use in debates and so forth, but it's also sort of punchily written, if I may put it that way, so it'll keep you entertained. And if you like audiobooks, I narrate the audiobook. Find out more at realdissent.com. Now, also, in terms of dates, I've told you I've got a thing coming up in Wichita, Kansas on Sunday, and then in January I'll be in Houston. The details on my events are always on the events page, tomwoods.com/events. You'll get them also if you subscribe to my newsletter at tomwoods.com. That's part of the newsletter, always is the calendar. Looks like I've lined something up. I'm not sure it's fully cast in stone, but I'd say we're 99% of the way there at Florida Atlantic University for February 2015, and of course my event in Dublin in May 2015. But it looks as if I'm going to be in Montreal for the weekend of, I think, somewhere around April 24th of 2015. If I have Canadian listeners, but particularly people who live in Montreal, who would like to do some kind of get-together or meet-and-greet or whatever while I'm in town, drop me a note through the contact page at tomwoods.com, and we'll see if we can line that up. Ben Swan returns to the program tomorrow. We'll see you then. Thanks for listening.
The Tom Woods Show.